Well, if you weren't here last week we started a series that's going to go all the way till mid-March called Naked and Unashamed. And last week, just very quickly, we looked at six road signs that are going to guide us on our journey. And those six road signs were no negative labeling, no throwing stones, people over issues, it's not a super sin, wake up to the world around us, and we talked about the Bible. And so, if you didn't listen to that first sermon, I really want to encourage you to go online, sanishbaptist.org, and listen to that sermon. It'll be really informative for you as we continue to journey together. And the goal of this series is that we will discover a holistic, biblical, Jesus-centered vision of sex, human sexuality, and gender that honors God, blesses relationships, and offers good news to the world in which we live. Now, what we're going to do today is we're going to go back to the first century. This is really, today is a bit of a different sermon. It's a history lesson, if you will. But as we go back to the first century, as we do that, here's what we need to make sure. We need to make sure that we don't read our 21st century postmodern understandings of human sexuality back into that world. The New Testament was not originally written to people living in a postmodern Western culture. Rather, it was written to a people steeped in first century Jewish or Greco-Roman culture. Thus, as I was saying last week, it is so important for us to grasp the prevailing sexual culture of that day, because then we can grasp what pertinent New Testament verses meant to those first hearers. And once we understand the culture, and once we understand what those verses meant to people living in that culture, then, and really only then, can we apply those scriptures to our 21st century lives and understandings. And I don't care how sexually fixated you think our postmodern culture is, it had nothing on the first century Greco-Roman world. The first century Greco-Roman culture, in that culture, sexual promiscuity, same-sex intercourse between adolescents and adults, prostitution were all accepted and were all the cultural norm. Rape of slaves was a given. Married men were expected to have affairs. There were very few sexual boundaries. Male prostitution directed at other males was not only taxed in the ancient Rome times, but the amount of tax collected made up a significant portion of the treasury. First century Greco-Roman culture could really be described in three words. Here's word number one. Word number one is power, or you could also use the word, if you wanted, domination, but I'm going to use the word power. Most erotic relationships in the Greco-Roman world exhibited some sort of power differential. There was the dominant partner, and there was the dominated partner. There was the master, and there was the slave. In the Roman mind, men were conquerors who dominated not only on the battlefield, but also in the bedroom. And so it was completely acceptable for a Roman male to have intercourse with a man or a woman, provided he was the aggressor. Males of social standing were to be the givers, not the receivers of sexual intercourse. The gender of the receiver didn't really matter. A warrior could penetrate a conquered male enemy. A master could penetrate a female household slave. Sexual intercourse with a male or a female was something a man did in that culture to someone as a way of expressing his power. Excuse me, a way of expressing his power. So the first word that describes the sexual culture was power. The second word was masculinity. This is really important to understand. The Greeks and the Romans did not understand sexuality in terms of sexual orientation, which is a person's enduring sexual attraction to others. They also didn't understand it in terms of gender identity. And gender identity is a person's self-identification as either male or female, which may or may not be the same as the sex assigned at birth. In that culture, they thought of sexualities in terms of gender roles. In other words, the societal constructed distinction between male and female, or between masculinity and femininity. And in other words, they didn't ask questions like, is Mike gay? Or say things like, if Mike had sex with Frank, they must both be gay. What mattered to them was Mike manly, or was Mike effeminate, as defined by their culture? In terms of sexual activity, the Romans saw the insertive role in either anal or vaginal sex as masculine, and the receptive role as feminine. So if a man had an insertive role, in other words, if a man was using his penis during sex, in a sexual encounter with either a male or a female, he was acting as a masculine male, and that was good. But if you were a male and you were a receptive partner in an anal sex encounter, you were considered effeminate. You were labeled soft and weak, not powerful and masculine and dominating. And so if you were a male and you were using your penis in the sex act, you were considered masculine. You were considered dominating. You were considered powerful. And that was all very good in that culture. Now, here's the third word. The third word is the word pederasty. And pederasty was a sexual relationship between an adult man and an adolescent boy. It was the most common form of same-sex relations in the Greco-Roman world. The word literally means the love of boys. And it was a 1,000-year-old social institution that enjoyed complete acceptance by both Greek and Roman society. In many circles, it was considered the purest form of love. For the Greek world, sex was all about the pursuit of beauty. And so for the Greeks, they were captivated by the beauty of the young male form. And ancient Greek texts are full of references to same-sex intercourse with boys because their beauty, at least they thought, their beauty was the most striking to the eye. And so a Greek man justified pederasty as a normal part of a boy's education. They saw the adult male as the teacher who would train the boys in matter of culture, social expectations, the ideals of manliness, and of course, sex. In the Roman culture, boys were learning to become Roman men of power and masculinity. And if you were learning that, you were expected to be the receiver of an adult male's sexual advances. The pederast relationship usually lasted as long as the boy didn't reach puberty. But once a boy started to grow facial hair and body hair, the relationship ended. And while some men ran around trying to hump everything and anything that couldn't run fast enough, it's wrong to say back then that all same-sex relationships were exploitive. There is certainly evidence from back in that time that peer-to-peer same-sex relations or even same-sex marriages occurred. Some men, some women engaged in same-sex relationships that were mutual, consensual, interdependent, and committed. They were not the norm. By no means were they the norm, but they did exist. I'll give you an example. There was a man named Agathon, a famous Greek poet known for his physical beauty. And he was also known for dressing up like a woman and having a lifelong consensual lover named Pausanias. And their relation began as pederasty, but it continued on after that. And so while they were the exception, committed same-sex relationships did occur. But certainly, and this is important to understand, certainly in the first century Greco-Roman culture, it was more about power and masculinity and less about love and commitment. Now, what about heterosexual marriage back then? Well, in the Greek-Roman world, what was heterosexual marriage like? Well, to the Greek-Roman mind, the relationship between man and woman was not the union of equals. You probably aren't surprised to hear that. A man's wife was seen beneath him, as less than him. Women back then were considered weak. They were treated like second-class human beings, treated barely better than slaves. A wife was under the authority of her husband. He had legal rights over her, and her value was tied to her ability to have children. Divorce on the grounds of infertility seemed very common back then. And while the husband was legally free to exercise his male desires with anyone he want beyond the bounds of marriage, he could go off and have a relationship with a young boy. He could go off and have a relationship with other males, females. He could do whatever he wanted. It wasn't true for the wife. A wife caught with another man would be charged as an adulteress. The penalty for adultery was that the husband was allowed to rape the male offender. And if he wanted, he could kill his wife. At minimum, back then, he was legally obligated to divorce his wife. Such was the state of heterosexual marriage in first century Greco-Roman culture. Now, what about the Jewish people? What did the Jewish people think about sexuality and all this craziness that was going on in the Greco-Roman culture? Well, the Jewish people in the first century did not approve of homosexual behavior. In fact, many Jewish writers thought sexual intercourse was designed solely for procreation. Therefore, homosexual unions were a non-starter because they couldn't procreate. That, along with the Old Testament teaching and the blurring of gender roles and the using of your body in a way it wasn't meant to be used and forcing another man to act like a woman, let the Jewish people back then consider homosexual behavior as simply wrong. In fact, a very prolific writer, well-known writer of the time, Josephus, who was Jewish to the core, but was also steeped in first century Roman Greco culture, had much to say about same-sex relations in his writing, and all of it was negative. For instance, Josephus asked the question, "What are our laws about marriage?" His answer was this, "The law owns no other mixture of sexes but that which is according to nature." Lewis Crompton, a gay man and a pioneer in queer studies, wrote in his well-known book, Homosexuality and Civilization, this, "Nowhere does any Jewish writer of this period imply the least acceptance of same-sex relations under any circumstances." The first century Jewish view was that same-sex relationships, as they understood them, were wrong. So let's summarize for a minute. The Jewish people looked at the Greco-Roman culture and they said, all that same-sex stuff, that's wrong. The Greco-Roman culture, on the other hand, said, we're all about male power, we're all about masculinity, we have very few sexual boundaries, and it's fine for men to have sex with boys, it's accepted, it's celebrated. And so you've got these two cultures, and into this first century culture came a movement of people who followed a man named Jesus. And as the movement grew, it went beyond the Jewish borders. In fact, most of the texts dealing with sexuality in the New Testament were written to Christ followers living within Roman, not Jewish, cities. That's important to know. So let's look quickly at one example today. And that example is the city of Corinth. The city of Corinth was founded around 800 BC. Its sexual promiscuity was absolutely legendary in the ancient world. In fact, when Corinth was under Greek control, the temple of Aphrodite was rumored to have had more than 1,000 prostitutes working there, meaning that the city of Corinth was the hub of sex tourism. But then in 146 BC, the city was destroyed as punishment for their role in revolt against Rome. Julius Caesar rebuilt it in 44 BC. And so in New Testament times, the city was under Roman control, and the temple of Aphrodite was considerably smaller than its heyday, but the culture of sexual promiscuity remained. And so you've got this city that's under Roman control, and all that I talked about earlier is happening there, and Paul starts a church in the city. Now, obviously, those who joined the church from the city would have been influenced by the culture, the sexual culture, attitudes, and activities of the day. So there was no doubt in that church there would have been men who had had same-sex intercourse. There would have been men who made use of prostitutes. There would have been men who participated in the sexual abuse of slaves. And when you understand all that, and you understand the culture of the day, you understand why the Corinthian church struggled with sexual issues. What's cool is they struggled with them. They didn't push those people out of the church. Something for us to learn right there. Paul wrote two letters to this church, and I want to read you a few verses from his first letter because I think it helps us understand Paul's mindset here. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 1 to 4, it says this: "Now for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman." Someone was asking that question of Paul. "But since sexual immorality is occurring, each man should have sexual relationships with his own wife and each woman with her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife." Paul says here, since sexual immorality is occurring, the Greek word, that's the original language the New Testament was written in, translated sexual immorality, is used in the New Testament to refer basically to any sex outside of marriage. And since sexual immorality was occurring, Paul said to the Christ followers in Corinth, in that church, in verse 2, each man should have sexual relationships with his own wife and each woman with her own husband. Paul here, because of the sexual immorality that was occurring, was limiting sexual activity to opposite-sex couples in marriage. His language here points to monogamy. One husband, one wife. Paul says here, that's the relationship. That's where your sexual desires are to be fulfilled. Do you understand how extremely countercultural those words were? They were off the chart countercultural. And also, I want you to notice this, the level of sexual equality in Paul's words, verse 3 and 4. "The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his body, but yields it to his wife." Now, when we're talking about the word duty here, please understand, we're not using the word duty in a negative sense. Paul here is calling husbands and wives to respect each other's sexual desires. I like the way verse 3 is placed, written in the Message paraphrase. It says this: "The marriage bed must be a place of mutuality. The husband seeking to satisfy his wife, and the wife seeking to satisfy her husband. Then in verse, let me read you another version. Verse 3 and 4 from the New Living Translation says this. The husband should fulfill his wife's sexual needs, and the wife should fulfill her husband's needs. The wife gives authority over her body to her husband, and the husband, catch these words, gives authority over his body to his wife. Do you notice the equality in these verses? Paul is stressing here that men and women are on equal terms. He's telling husbands, your body is not your own to do with as you want. You don't just get to go out and mess around and have anal sex with young boys. You don't get to go out and just break the marriage vows with whoever you want. You don't get to treat your wife like she's a slave, she's your sex slave. No, Paul says, you're equal. And we go, well, of course, because we look at it from a 21st century view. But understand, in the Roman and rabbinical Jewish law, a woman's sexuality was essentially under the authority of her husband. But in Christianity, a woman found she was sexually equal with her husband in the marriage union. You know, one of the things I love about the New Testament and Christianity is in that New Testament period, as we've already seen, women were oppressed in so many ways, and along comes Jesus, along comes the church, and lifts women out of oppression and says, you're equal. I think it's really unfortunate in today's society where culture says women are lifted out of oppression that some in the church want to oppress women. And I think, whoa, what are we doing? We need to always be lifting women high and making sure that we as a church are not oppressing them. Amen? Thank you for that. Whew, okay. But here's what I want you to see. It's a countercultural shift Paul's calling for. Have you caught it? Paul's saying, back then it was all about self. It was all about taking. If you were a male, it's all about power. It's about masculinity. It's about doing whatever you want. And Paul says, no, I want you to change. This isn't about taking. This isn't about self. Paul says, I want you to focus, instead of on self, on the other. I want the husband to focus on the wife and the wife to focus on the husband. I want you, instead of focus on taking, I want you to focus on giving. Do you see how countercultural that is? Paul was calling these new Christ followers to break away from the cultural norms and values of the day. He's saying you're no longer to live by the sexual values of the Greco-Roman culture. They were now to live as kingdom people with kingdom values. Now, I was thinking about that this week, and I'm thinking, wow, living by those values back then would have caused the Christ followers in Corinth to stick out like sore thumbs. I mean, I can only imagine how weird the early church must have seemed, like an Amish community planted in downtown Las Vegas, right? They were outcasts. They were radicals. They were living by different values because they were living in a different kingdom. The question then becomes, how should we then live in the 21st century? We live in a very different time than the Greco-Roman culture in many ways. What was okay in the first century culture, what was accepted and celebrated sexually, we as a culture in our country consider wrong. If you're a guy and you go have sex with a 12-year-old boy, you're going to go to jail. We today say power and masculinity are not something we should overtly celebrate as the be-all and end-all when it comes to sex. That's what the Me Too campaign is all about. And we as a church should be championing that. Sexual harassment, sexual abuse is wrong. While in the first century there was inequality in marriage and women were looked down on, and that included sexual inequality, our culture wouldn't take that today. And so how do we live? And while the first century may have been more sexually promiscuous, I would say our culture is way more sexually complicated. They didn't think in the sexual terms and categories that we think in. So how are we to live in this sexually complicated world? How do we apply Paul's words today? Do we just take them and apply them? Do they fit? Do they work? Paul was writing to a very different culture. Are we supposed to live like an Amish community in downtown Las Vegas? How are Christ followers supposed to live today? Stay tuned. Same bat time, same bat channel. Because next week, what we're going to do is this. Again, I can't stress how important, you'll see as we go over these next weeks, how important this is, that we understand the first century. You'll understand why that's so important in coming weeks. But next week, we're going to move to the 21st century. And we're going to look at our 21st century culture. And what we're really going to look in at as we look at a 21st century worldview is we're going to look at the individual, because that's so important to understand. And then we're going to look at the whole Christian worldview in light of all of this. And so can I ask you just to be patient with me as we journey through this stuff, as we go through the worldviews? Because some of you are saying, get to the issues. We will. But in order to get to the issues, heterosexuality, homosexuality, transgender issues, we need to have a firm foundation and understanding from which we're working from, right? And so this week it was first century, next week 21st century, Christian worldview, and then we will get to the issues. And so I want to encourage you again to be praying as we go through this series, to be open-minded as to how where God's going to lead us. And also, if you know people that aren't here and are missing the sermons, I think it's really important that they're going to build on one another. So if you miss, go back and listen to it online. If others who are normally here are not here today, encourage them to listen to the sermon online, so we can all journey together. Let me pray for you. Father, thank you for this day. Thank you for your goodness and your grace. Father, thank you that you have preserved your word and that we're going to learn from your word. Thank you that you've also given us insights to other cultures and understandings. And God, I just pray that as we journey through these weeks, Father, you will help us understand how we can have a vision that is really from the heart of God on human sexuality. And that we'll see how that vision not only honors you, but is good news to the world in which you live. In Jesus' name, amen.